This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Time for another completely unnecessary podcast for Wednesday, September 23. Wow, we're already in the fall, 2015, alongside Ian Ferguson. I'm Pat Contry. We've got a lot of fun going on today. Retro gaming news, modern gaming news, maybe a strike, and one movie topic that will be fun because I'll be vindicated, and Q&A. On the show, we'll be discussing Konami officially stopping AAA game production, GameStop no longer bundling with digital copies, no longer selling bundles with digital copies, potential voice actor strike, Japanese games drying up due to U.S. consumers, the Retro VGS Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign, that drama, Mighty No. 9 demo delayed, another GameStop retro story, and my fun topic, as well as Q&A coming from you guys. Ian, what's going on?
Not a whole lot. I've been working on... Myself and my friends have been working on getting a Dungeons & Dragons group together, actually. Because, I mean, why not just buy in all the way to the nerd image? it was something that I had played in high school a bit, and it was never any fun.
Was never fun?
I mean, well, it was fun, but, you know, D&D is all about the group of people you have, and the DM being on the same page as the players and understanding what kind of difficulty they're looking for.
DM is Dungeon Master for the uninitiated.
I'm pretty sure most people know what that is. And these groups dissolved quickly, but, you know, we're older, we all kind of know what we want out of it, and I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be fun. What's funny is...
I didn't get an invite.
You would role play?
I could role play.
Yeah.
I have. That's my private conversation.
what was hilarious, though, is that I was talking to my parents today, and without even bringing it up, I was just catching up with them because I hadn't spoken to them in a week or so. And my mom was like, oh, you know, I'm working, and, you know, I started drawing again recently. And she's like, and your dad and I are playing Dungeons & Dragons again. And I was like, wait a second. You gotta be fucking kidding me. You guys are playing again? Because they used to play all the time when I was very, very young. So I just find it interesting that, unaware of what I'm doing or what they're doing, we both got back into it at the same time.
I don't know why you wouldn't think I'd be able to do it.
Not that you wouldn't want to do it.
Why wouldn't I?
Because you're a busy man and it's a regular thing.
Well, busy, but I mean, if I had the time to do stuff like enjoy life again, that'd be something I would like to do. It could be fun. Frank used to do it way back in the day.
Oh, I believe it.
But he was just a little bit too old to... You know, at the time when it came out, to really get into it, you know, he
sure.
was like out of it. But
well, there's all sorts of different ways that people will role play too. There are the people who really get into it and talk in character, which is not particularly my thing.
I wouldn't do that.
No, and then there are people who, I mean, the way I like to do it is basically this: like, I have to DM this time around, and what I've basically told people is, look, you don't have to get crazy into the role playing, but play your character the way you created it. So if your character is chaotic. Good, then play them that way. If they're evil, you have to play them that way. That's all I require of you.
Yeah.
You
know, stay consistent. It's like a stage play.
Right, exactly. Play your character within the boundaries that you created them, and that's all I need. If you want to speak in third person, if you want to say my character does X as opposed to I'm going to venture forth, that's fine.
I forgot what Frank says his character's name was. You got to ask him what the race of the character was. I forget what it was. It was like a mixture of two different ones, if that's possible.
Well, you can. There's always been like half orcs, half elves.
I think it was something like that. He told me, but he remembered the name. It was funny as hell to know. For, yeah, I was that, and just saying it like that was just funny.
That's funny.
And I was a half orc, you know.
It's funny how into it some people. I mean, how mainstream it's become. I mean,
I think it's fine.
People aren't ashamed of it anymore. It's something that lots of people do.
I don't see why you'd be ashamed of something like that, where to me it's almost like just like a glorified, I mean, more than a board game, but it's just the same sort of thing. You get together.
It's group storytelling.
Yeah. with some fun, like, action random elements thrown in, whatever.
Sure.
I wouldn't see a reason to make fun of that. Now, you show me some of those LARPing videos, then maybe it's a different story. But anyway, we're going to be at the Retro Gaming Expo, October 17th and 18th.
And we are. That's going to be exciting.
We're going to do a podcast live, a guide-in podcast, because I think, according to the schedule, that'll be a week after the last one, so we could either do that for the next Wednesday or do a short one and do a short one after. So we'll have to play it by ear. You're going to get two podcasts that week, and I'm going to be doing my Pat the NES Punk panel, or whatever I call it at this point, since what happened to Pat the NES Punk, who knows. I'll get to that in a second. So that's going to be Sunday morning, and our podcast is on Saturday. How did I not get prime time? Oh, well. Either way, it's fun. And come out, say hi to us, buy your retro wares there, and games. And, yep, I'll probably have some sort of announcement for there, being that I'm working on this book project that is taking the life out of me. Not even slowly, just steadily. But the good news is that it's, like, turned the corner to the point where now it's just, like, waiting for the rest of the material to come in from other people and just compiling it, which is a lot better than writing it. And so it's, like, if you had to put an estimate of how much is actually compiled together, I'd say two-thirds compiled. Because it's, like, the way this works, folks, is that, like, you have the entries for all games, this review book. So we're talking 750-plus. I think the final count in the North American section is, like, 760, something like that. Something like that. It's in that range. So you have the written parts for everything. I'm taking a good amount of mouth. Written parts for everything. And then you have, you know, like, four screenshots per game. You have a cart image, which might look a little snazzier than you might expect per game. And then you have to place that all on the page. Then you have a background image for each page as well, which I decided I'm going to do that because, you know what, I need an extra step to kill myself.
It looks nice.
It does look nice. Thank you, Ian. So that takes a lot of time to do that. And so there's not just that. There's going to be supplemental material. You're going to have, like, something from James Rolfe on the horror NES games. From Norman Caruso, the gaming historian, is going to have a little ditty on the Tengen NES lawsuit. So that's going to be fun. I'm going to have other writings in there as well. And there might be special sections as well if the space permits it. And I have the foreword being done by good old pal of mine, I guess now his pal, Blake Harris, author of Console Wars, is doing the foreword. Yeah, it's going to be cool, and it'll hopefully be for pre-order sometime in October, knock on wood, in both digital and physical version. It's going to be a big book. It's going to be like 450 pages. It's going to be hardcover. You'll be able to kill someone with this book. It's killing me. But no, actually, you know, I'll be proud of it. I'm the type of person where I'm hard to actually be proud of something until it's in my hand and done. So at this point, it's just sort of get it done, and then I could get back to the rest of my life, which includes, I mean, the podcast doesn't take a huge amount of time in terms of us sitting down. Rendering it, yeah, that's a little more, but I don't have to worry about it after a couple of days, usually. It's just monitoring it, and, you know, it's like the podcast is like a plant. Initially, you got to do a lot of watering, and you put the dirt in, then you look at it, and you do a little each day, but after that, you know, it takes care of itself, for the most part. But something like Pat the NES Punk is like digging a ditch and throwing yourself into it. So it's a lot of work, and at the end, it's pain. But the good news about that is, though, I'm going to get back to that. When the book is done, I'm definitely going to get back to that. But I have a sort of a minor episode that I'm hopefully going to do for October, and hopefully a Halloween one. Once the book is done, I could concentrate on that, and then...
Your now traditional November 4th Halloween episode.
I don't appreciate that, Ian. I don't appreciate that one bit. But then we might do the NES Marathon. It's not set in stone yet. If we do that, there's no way we could do it in October. I would have loved to do it for the 30th anniversary, but we'll be at Retro Gaming Expo that weekend of the NES 30th anniversary. It's October 18th. So, but if we do, it'll be in November, but there'll be no announcements made until the book pre-order is set and done, because then I cannot work on more than what I'm working on now. I just can't physically. And that's what's going on. So Pat the NES Punk is not dead. He'll be back. I wish I could announce something else that has to do with me, but I can't until that comes out as well. And that's been in the works for like 4 months, so that could be cool. So, GameStop.
Yes. GameStop came out, I think it was late last week, and basically, said that they are no longer interested in selling Video game bundles that contain digital copies. Now, this has become something that happens quite regularly in the realm of console sales. I think I first started noticing it happening very frequently with Nintendo consoles, the 3DS especially. Very early on in the 3DS's lifespan, they sort of started foregoing a physical version of the game for a digital copy that was already downloaded onto the system, or you got a code. They did the same thing with the Wind Waker HD bundle. Now, they didn't commit to it really solidly. For instance, the Mario Kart 8 bundle had a physical copy. But most recently, I believe it was the Xbox One and the PS4, had system bundles that would come with a digital copy of Madden, and the most recent Madden. And what GameStop did was is they created basically a third-party bundle, which is where they take their own physical systems and work out a deal with the publisher, such as EA, to give out a free copy of the physical game. I feel two ways about this. On one hand, I know a lot of people who really like physical copies of games. And I think that that's going to gain some favor for GameStop. I mean, if this story is more well known, it's a pretty, I think that what it is it looks like a consumer friendly move for people who are anti-digital. What's really going on here is GameStop is showing once again that they're kind of shaking in their boots here. The real reason a company like GameStop wants to include a physical copy with their system sales, if there's a bundle, is not because it's going to make the customer happy. The customer is going to buy it one way or another if it has a free game. They're doing it because it creates copies of games that can come back into their circulation. They don't make any money off of new games.
What are they making off a $60 game? $5?
Well, let's put it this way. If I'm making maybe $2 off of a new game sale, they're probably making maybe $10 off of a new game sale because they will get better rates than we do.
Okay.
And I find, but then again, now if that game comes back to them and they pay $20 in credit for it and they sell it for $55, now all of a sudden they're making a much larger margin. So, I mean, the article that we, the Giant Bomb article where this broke, they were, kind of making fun of GameStop and saying they got to get with the times and realize that this is how it's going to be done. And there is some truth to that. GameStop needs to adjust their models on a lot of things real quick if they hope to stay competitive. I mean, we see them flailing and trying all sorts of things. Separate stores for iPads and phones and things like that. Their retro initiative and now, things like this. But I do think that that's a little harsh. People think that I'm constantly just bashing GameStop to bash GameStop. I don't think that as many people are willing to adopt digital quite yet as perhaps the article is jumping to conclusions about.
It's just the way of the world. There's going to be more and more people buying digital just because... Well, right now, a lot of times it's not cheaper, which to me is really strange. How it would even be, $10 cheaper? Since, why wouldn't it be? Since there's no cost to download it. There's no cost to ship somewhere.
No, I agree with that. I mean, digital
to me is weird. Until Microsoft and Sony and Nintendo get that part figured out, then that would really lead to more, I think, people digital. Because then, unfortunately, I always would buy physical over digital just because you can trade it or can sell it back.
Right.
That's a positive. Or transfer it to another system a lot easier. So that's good. But in this case, GameStop just wants to make sure they're not out of business in 5 years.
Right.
That's what it comes down to. But I think they should really look at it the other way and try to embrace it as much as they can. GameStop's going to be gone at some point. It's just, when is it going to be gone?
Right.
15 years, 20, or 5. That's probably what you're going to look at with something like GameStop.
We're living in a game era where, and I've said it before, and you've said it before too, whether it's this next generation or the generation after that, we are going to see something that is digital only. I mean, we've got Steam machines, which if you want to look at them as consoles, are digital only. But the thing about Steam is there's constantly sales, and games are very cheap.
I'm not sure we'll always go to digital only. I'll have to see it first because I think there might be backlash from it because there's always going to be those areas where, and even in this day and age, not everyone has good internet, depending on where you live. Some parts of the world, you're not going to have good internet. I think there always will be room for physical. But GameStop can't survive if only 10 or 20% of people are buying physical.
Right.
That's the problem. And if people aren't obviously trading back in, then it dries out. So I'm surprised GameStop never got in with GameFly and went in that direction. I'm really surprised they didn't take a bid or run at them to say, hey, if we can't at least get free stock back in to resell back to people via used games, let's get into the rental market and do that and help. And they never did. That could be a mistake.
And I think that's an opportunity that's long past them. I mean,
yeah, it's sort of like how Blockbuster let Netflix get too big before
they did their own.
They gave Netflix. I know this firsthand because I used to work at a company where I did market research for Blockbuster, and Blockbuster gave Netflix a 3-year head start, and that's all they needed to be crushed.
A 3-year head start was, I mean, far more than they needed. I feel like, I mean, even letting them go 2 years or a year.
Could have been two only, but it was definitely at least a couple years. And at that point, Blockbuster took a long time to get their service, competitive service, which they did have a competitive service, remember. They did have
for a moment.
For a couple years, a few years, they tried it.
It was neat, too. You could take it and return it immediately to the store.
That was a good positive, but they didn't have the infrastructure that Netflix had already in terms of all the locations throughout the U.S. where you literally could get a movie the next day, and Blockbuster didn't have that figured out yet. It was too slow to move, and so it never caught up to the level serves that Netflix had already perfected, and that was one of the reasons Blockbuster died out.
And as soon as Netflix launched streaming, I mean, Blockbuster was not able to handle that.
Oh, yeah, but they were dead before that, before the streaming got big like 3-4 years ago even. They were dead before that.
So
GameStop, not sure what to tell you.
Yeah.
You put other stores out of business, you're going to go the same way. It's capitalism. But this time it is. I'm not sure what to say. I don't feel happy about it. I feel bad about the retro stuff more, which we'll get into later.
Yeah, I mean, the last thing I'd say is, for the time being, it's good for consumers, but it's not going to save GameStop in the long run. And I just wanted to point out the hilarity of the first bundle where they seemed to put their foot down about this was a sports game bundle. And quite frankly, I will buy sports games digitally. You know why? Because they're worth fuck all once you buy them. You can't trade them back for a goddamn thing. So when I bought MLB 15 The Show, I was like, you know what? It's midnight and I want that right now. And I bought it digitally.
You have about 3 days to trade it back.
Right. So I just find it weird that that's where they were like, no, we need these copies of Madden coming back in.
It has a half-life like those periodic table elements that you can't say the names of.
Yeah.
The ones that are discovered and exist for like a nanosecond.
So moving on to
Konami.
Video games changing. Konami is officially stopping AAA game production. Everyone called this. It's not just us. As soon as Metal Gear Solid 5 was obviously going to be, you know, they scrubbed Kojima's name, and I mean, that was kind of like the last thing they talked about. Nothing had been announced. PT was canceled. We all knew this was coming.
Silent Hills was gone.
So, what do we have? The way I read it was next year's PES, Pro Evolution Soccer game, was going to be their last AAA release. Now, that sounded weird to me. Why would they go a year without releasing anything else? I think what it means is PES 2016, the one that's coming out now, will be their last big release. And then it's pachinko machines and gambling and mobile games. And that whole fucking thing that we that we talked about, was it last podcast or two podcasts ago? That poll. It's exactly as we said, it's all going to be for digital shit, or they're going to make a fucking Rocket Knight pachinko machine or some bullshit.
I don't think they're going to make a Rocket Knight pachinko machine, which they might, because I've seen Frogger, you know, slot machines in casinos and stuff, but yeah, you're not going to see a big-time title like that ever again, which is unfortunate. Now, for the soccer, real quick, for the soccer, it's interesting, though, because soccer games are sports games are 95% the same game year to year. So for that, you figure maybe with that they could do a more limited team and just sort of kind of update it year after year for the next 3-4 years. And if people buy it, then it's not a lot of investment for them. Start from scratch.
I think the problem is there was a long time where Pro Evolution Soccer, it was once called Winning 11, I think even International Superstar Soccer at one point, was for a long time considered the soccer game. You know, it put FIFA. Put FIFA to shame. But in recent years, it's really fallen, and I think that's kind of indicative of where Konami was and where they were headed, that they were letting one of their flagship global titles kind of fall apart. And it's sad, because I used to love Pro Evolution Soccer, and I almost want to buy 2016, because it's the last game, but I know it's going to suck. I know it's not going to be any good. So, I mean, it's sad, but...
Just a roster update and that's it.
I'm not kidding. It's probably a roster update from 2015 and that's all it is. They just shoveled it out the door.
Hey, get 10 people on the project and that's all. Just update it for the next few years. Graphics don't have to update. Just update the rosters and the teams and add a couple of new modes in.
So... I mean, this really kind of bums me out, though, because you got to think about Konami's legacy here. It's actually bothered me more than I would thought. From small things like never seeing another powerful pro baseball title again, which were great. Those were the baseball games with the big heads and the disembodied hands and legs with no arms. No Castlevania. The likelihood of a Rocket Knight or a Track and Field Resurrection, not likely. I took for granted how many games Konami made that I truly enjoyed, and it bums me the fuck out that, I mean, that's just sliced off.
My favorite publisher on the NES was Konami.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely did a really goddamn good job.
Bang up job. Look at the silver titles right there, buddy. Look at those titles.
Yeah, because Bayou Billy's a gem.
You go right to Bayou Billy.
So is Bill Elliott's NASCAR.
Okay, what about the rest? Okay.
No, but I mean, honestly, I mean, great stuff. I mean, good stuff all around. I'm not a huge total Capcom modern fan, but I would actually have to say that Capcom was probably my favorite publisher on the NES.
Oh, yeah.
Capcom Sunsoft.
That Lone Ranger game is excellent. Now I said that the price is going to go up, people think, but no one played that Lone Ranger.
Lone Ranger actually is a little bit more expensive now anyways.
4.5 stars in the NES guidebook, by the way.
It's a goddamn good game.
Damn right it is.
All right.
So I don't know what else to say. It's just a crying shame that... It's a
goddamn shame.
We might get some, digital download games of a new Contra or something, but it's not going to be the same, I guess, not having... I don't know. Konami, what happened? Well, it all went downhill when Pearl left.
Where did our love go,
when
Konami?
Pearl left Konami, I knew tough times were ahead.
No, she was gone because tough times were already there.
It all fell apart because of Pearl. This is somewhat recent, but it's been going on for a while. The SAG-AFTRA, which is they represent the voice actors. I guess there's a voice actors guild. I didn't know that. I knew there was Actors Guild, but they're the Voice Actors Guild. So they've been trying to negotiating all this year with the major, AAA studios like EA, Ubisoft, Disney, about having some new agreement put in place for voice actors.
Mm-hmm.
So amongst those requests that they're trying to get, and there's a divide. Usually when you threaten a strike, there's going to be a divide, and that's what they're doing. The voice actors are threatening to strike. The ones that are in SAG. So they want stunt pay, in quotes, for vocally stressful performances. I guess if you have to yell a lot, it could damage your vocal cords. They also want to have stunt coordinators available when motion capture or movement is involved in the recording. I'm guessing if they mean... I'm not familiar with that in terms of voice actors also doing, like, rolling around, or
yes.
They mean just,
so,
like...
I can fill that in a little bit.
Fill that in a little bit for
you. Because I think it'll shade my opinion. So a lot of times now, voice actors, especially if they're voice acting a role for a video game, they will also do the mocap work.
So they'll run with a gun in their hand?
Because you're doing the voice acting, and what better way to do your acting than to act out what you're doing?
Sure.
So they also get in so sometimes, for some games, they're in the mocap suit, they're the ones who are doing... the walking, the running, the rolling around, that sort of thing. I mean, and that's to give their voice acting believability and weight, essentially.
So they want quarters on hand. I guess if there's something dangerous done. I'm not too familiar with what's been done. If people are rappelling down green screen walls, I don't know. Then the biggest one, and this is the one that probably is why you're probably going to have a strike, is that they want back-end residuals for... games that make at least $2 million, they want back-end residuals to kick in, and then once they reach 4, they want it to scale up to more residuals, and then once it reaches 6 million in sales, they want it to reach more. So that's going to be the sticking point here, and I'm not sure where this is going to go. So we're in a weird stage now, then, because by doing this, what the voice actors are saying, you cannot have, basically what they're saying is you cannot have games be as successful without us participating. That's what they're saying. This is sticky, and I'll be totally honest. I'm totally on their side when it comes to having a stunt coordinator. If it has to be dangerous, that makes sense to me. For quote unquote hazard pay, if your voice goes out, that to me, I could go either way on that, because if it's part of the job description that you have to yell a lot, that's some sort of risk involved with that. And of course, they're gonna have to hire someone else. Like anything, if you can't do it, if your voice goes, you have to hire someone else. And maybe there's insurance involved. That I don't know. Maybe that's part of the reason why they're in the union. Maybe they would pay for that. In terms of the residuals, I got a problem with that. I'm not gonna mince words about it. I have a big problem with them demanding residuals. The amount of work they're putting into these projects. Some are more significant than others, but these are not making or breaking these games. They are not, them being in here. They are not programming, they're not designing, they're not doing the art on this, they are not doing the QA on this. They are, to me, the icing on the cake of these games. Not to say that they're worthless, not saying that at all, but whoever they would have got to voice Solid Snake and Metal Gear Solid 5, you didn't need Kiefer Sutherland, you could have got anyone else to do it, and it would have sold the same amount. So, I just hope they're not biting off more than they can chew, because you know what? They can have scabs come in very easily and do work that'll be just as good, probably, because a lot of the times you hear about voice acting being really bad in games. Now, that's not always on the voice actor. That could be on the bad scripts that are being written, which, again...
could also be bad based on bad pacing. I'm gonna let you finish, but before, I just want to say that more often than not, when I think voice acting is awful in a game, it's not the voice actor, it's the pacing of when the sound cues come in, and that's on the programming.
Yeah, and to me, that's not, and that has nothing to do with me putting value on the work or not. I'm just saying it is what it is, and that they're not making or breaking these game sales. They're not actors making or breaking a movie. That's totally different. Because in a movie, the acting is a good, I'd say, 2/3 of the movie is the acting. You have the directing, you have the acting, you have the writing. In a game, they are a minute part of that experience. Even with all the cutscenes in games and all the stories in games. No one's going out and buying the next Call of Duty because their favorite voice actor's in it. That's my point. So I would love to see the details of how much they're demanding. If it's a minute amount, where it's like, okay, we want, like, I don't even know what's fair, what's built in their contract. We get 0.1% of the sales or something so minute that, yeah, here's a little flavoring, like when you appear as an extra in a movie. That's the best way I would do an analogy. They're like an extra in a movie. They can get a residual if they're in the union, but it's a very, very small amount. They're not going to be getting paid, 5% or 10% like a movie actor who's a big movie actor like Robert Downey Jr. He can negotiate, okay, next Avengers movie, I want, 4%. Of the profit, and they'll say, "Okay, we have to, because without you, no one will see this, or a lot less people do."
Well,
you know,
I mean, this is how I feel about it. As far as the stunt coordinator and whatnot during anything that's involving mocap that they feel like is dangerous, I'm 100% on board with. As far as the damage, the potential damages, I'm like you. I'm kind of half and half. I understand it. It's like, I mean, you look at, not to sound silly, but it's like you look at a hand model, right? But I'm serious.
George Costanza.
They ruin their hand. They lose their ability to make a living off of what they're doing. Voice actors make their money off of their voices, and if they damage their voice doing something, I do believe that there at least should be some sort of compensation period while they figure out what they're going to do.
But you know what? A hand model can get their hands insured. The same way models get their legs insured.
No, I realize this.
And so, like, you can do that. You can go to MetLife or whatever, and get insurance for all that.
Well, if a voice actor can get their voice insured, then that's a whole different.
Yeah,
thing.
I wish I knew more about the union and what their union fees entailed. Like,
sure.
if it entailed some sort of hazard pay built in or something, I have no idea.
As far as the back end deal thing, I'm gonna have to disagree with you a little bit. While I agree with you that no one is rushing out to buy a game because their favorite voice actor is in it, I do not think they are icing on the cake, and I do not think they are a bit part. I do not think anyone at this point can imagine video games without voice. And as time goes on, there are voice actors who get more well-known, and there are voice actors who people identify as a character, especially if it's a long-running series. I don't think it's unreasonable, because sure. My understanding is that voice actors do not make much. So if a character is... because Kiefer Sutherland has not always played Snake. I can't remember the guy who who did.
They loved the guy that came before him. I don't remember his name, but he did it up to this point.
Was it John? I don't know if it was. No, I don't think it was John St. John. But either way,
he was a comic book. He was in the guy in the comic books.
But
Hayden.
Sure,
David Hayter.
Yes, that's right. So honestly, this is a guy who embodies the character that of a game that people love. And if a game does particularly well, yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with him making extra money based on the sales,
sure,
as long as what they are requesting is reasonable.
But
the problem is we don't have any sort of details as to what they're asking. So I can't, because if they're asking too much, I'm going to say that's unreasonable. But if they're not asking for a ton, I got to admit, I don't think there's any problem with them receiving additional pay at various benchmarks.
But this is what I'm going to say, though. If that actor is so big, like a David Hayter, which apparently wasn't, since he's not on Metal Gear Solid 5, they didn't need him anymore.
No, it's because Konami didn't give a fuck.
My point is, then, if you're that integral part, and if you don't think that they can sell them without you, you know what? Negotiate it with your agent to say, I want these residuals. And you can't make that part of it.
I'm wondering if this whole bid for residuals is coming about because they don't get a higher pay rate, and it's a stopgap until they find a way to get paid more or treated as a more integral part. Because like I said, you may think that they are icing on the cake, but we cannot go back to silent video games.
No, but my point is that you don't need a unionized voice actors guild in order to get competent voice actors to do this work. You just don't.
I don't know.
You don't think
that
people do competent voice acting? You know how hard it is to get into SAG if you're an actor? There's plenty of good actors.
Sure.
So, they can get scabs in a second.
There are people out there who are not part of any union right now who are doing great voice actor work, but I don't know. I don't really have an issue with any of this. It really depends on the finer details.
I'm going to come back to the fact that it just bothers me that if they're going to do this, then that programmer who worked on the game for hundreds of hours that year is getting no residuals versus someone that worked on the game for 5 hours and they demand back pay for that. That bothers me. I'm sorry, that just bothers me on a primitive sort of level.
Yeah, but from what I understand, there are oftentimes like bonuses associated with sales points reached for people who worked on the game. So, if that's the case,
I want to see what this is. Then I want to see what this is. If they make $4 million, they throw $5,000 at someone or $10,000. I'd be like, all right. But if they want like hundreds of thousands of dollars,
I highly doubt that's it. Look, I'll meet you halfway on this. This is what I would say: if programmers and artists can receive bonuses for sales goals met, then so should the voice actors who worked on the game. If they are not capable of getting those bonuses, then the voice actors should probably take a look at their role in the game and deal with the fact that maybe they don't deserve those bonuses. But I think it's a matter of play fairly and play equal, and I'm not saying the bonus has to be the same for the voice actors. It can be a fraction of what a programmer made, but if there are bonuses involved for sales goals met for anyone who worked on the game, then it should only be fair for everyone to be included in that.
Okay. I could sort of go in that direction, but at this point, I'm not going to get too much into it, but doing a hashtag performance matters and trying to do that, that's just weird to me. Your voice acting. I'm not trying to belittle what you're doing, but your voice acting.
Interesting article by Chris Kohler here. I actually saw the picture he used for it on Twitter the other day. Talking about how Akihabara and game stores in Japan are drying up, and they're not the import game mecca that they once were. Which is kind of sad, because I feel like everyone's idealized video game vision of Japan, where you walk into the City of Lights and you go into any store and you can take your pick and choosing of any systems and get something that you're looking for, it's no longer there. Akihabara has turned into largely an anime trinket place as opposed to a video game, a retro video game heaven. It's interesting that he notes that a lot of the reason these things are drying up is due to U.S. popularity of various systems and an interest in imports. The increased prominence of eBay, which is not recent, I mean, obviously that was like early 2000s, but especially now, has led to a worldwide market where anyone who wants these imports, even if it's kind of a fraction of the gaming community, they can get it. And there are a lot of Japanese sellers that cater almost exclusively to the U.S. market. One of my favorite online ones, RioPlan Shop, you know, is largely catering to the U.S. market, and they sell all these imports. So what you have is, and he actually says this is one of the worst systems affected. The PC Engine, a system that I love.
It's your fault.
Yeah, it's my fault entirely. Blame me. So what you have is instead of one store servicing one area, even a busy area like Akihabara, is now, say that store is now opening its doors to the entire world. And what you are left with are desolated and empty shelves. And, I mean, basically things that no one's looking to pick up. And it's going to damage them in the long run, because while they are selling to these global markets, you cannot necessarily maintain a shop if you have nothing in it. And, I mean, and that's why we've been seeing over the past decade, you know, even some bigger name Japanese game stores closing down and shuttering and having something more profitable like an anime store or a manga store open up, because it's almost, I would say, and I can't state this for certain, but a lot of people have kind of implied this to me, the interest in retro games in Japan is dying. You couple that with the increased interest in retro games, import games in the U.S. and other places like PC Engine and Super Famicom, and you end up with stores that have no way to stay open in their home country. Mm-hmm. So, that's where we are. And this is, he writes the article now, but this is something I've been hearing from my friends who traveled to Japan a lot for years. 8 years ago, I could ask a buddy to grab me a copy of Dracula X, and he can find it for me for $55. Nowadays, you 200. Know... Well, if that, he even mentions it in his article. Chris is trying to find, you know, copies of Mother, you know, to bring home to his friends, a game that was wildly popular over there, despite not being popular here. And the few that he finds are behind glass cases now with insane price tags, because kind of like we talked about with U.S. games and things like Contra, they're leaving the shelves and not coming back to those stores.
Sure.
So, the price goes up.
I mean, yeah. The U.S. market's a lot bigger, so of course it's going to be drawn out than
yes.
The Japanese market, you know, because the population is like, what, six times the size of Japan or more, seven times, something like that, and you have the retro game craze going on. You see games going to Europe. You see games going everywhere. You find out, oh, these people in Europe have NWC cards. Some people own them there, so it goes all over. I get concerned sometimes about games leaving the U.S. and going elsewhere. Because who knows if they come back. I mean, there's a lot more of that, though. There's a lot more U.S. carts than Japanese carts, though. So that's...
I don't know about that.
Comparatively. For, okay. Like, something like NES versus Famicom. You know, there's more.
Sure. Bigger market.
That's what I mean. So, of course, prices are going to go up. For a store not being able to stock their shelves, I mean, I guess that's not the worst problem to have if you're making money, if you're selling stuff, but... If you're selling retro games, though, it's not a new product, and that's to be expected. Eventually, it's going to run out. Eventually,
right.
All retro game stores are going to run out of whatever was popular before to sell. It's going to be gone.
Well, and I think something that I meant, I kind of didn't describe it properly. I don't think that a lot of these stores are also doing online. I'm sure some of them are, but I think a lot of them, plenty of them, are probably still just physical location stores, but the online stores are the ones that are shipping all these cartridges overseas, creating no stock for the physical stores.
Yeah, they're the ones buying them there,
yeah.
and they can mark them up and sell them here.
Right.
I go to some of these conventions, and there's guys that always have, they get FM Towns Marty systems, you know? That's not an easy system to find them again with, even in Japan, and they're getting them over here to
right.
sell. So there's less and less every year. They're not making this stuff anymore. Every time you see someone making their hacked up little Samson from the Famicom version, that's one less Famicom version of the game.
Yeah.
You know, they're not coming back.
And it's not like, it's not necessarily a cautionary tale, it's just what happens with a finite supply of things. But, there is a very real chance that this is a possible prediction of the future for the U.S. retro game market.
Oh, I think we're heading that direction.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, like I say, when I can't keep them... When I don't get as... When I have no Super Mario 2s or 3s for 2 weeks, something's fucking going on. Especially when I'm paying like 10 in cash, 20 in credit for them, and most people don't believe they're worth more than $8. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's fucked up.
So, if you go to Japan, try to. I'm sure there's some spots that you can still get to. I've heard stories about maybe there's lots of games could be in Hong Kong. I've heard. I know a guy that claims he has knows a guy, I think in Taiwan, that has an underground like warehouse of new games going back to the 80s still shoved in a warehouse underground that when he told me my eyes like sort of lit up. We're talking just like they can't, like the further back you go, the older the games get. That's you can't walk. There's like, all right, here's the N64 era right in front of us, but behind that's a 16-bit, behind that's the 8-bit.
Right.
So there's probably still something out there to be found and restock the supply, but eventually it runs out. You say that, and then of course then they find a bunch of Caltron 6-in-1s in Mexico. So who knows?
A month after I saw you mine.
Yeah, thanks.
Hey, let's have a metered conversation about the retro VGS.
Okay, we're going to try to unpack this slowly and surely, and we'll just back up. People have been asking us to talk about the retro VGS all summer, and we had opinions about it all summer.
Yep.
However, we wanted to try to be fair and objective, believe it or not, and wait until we saw what was actually going to be offered via what we thought was going to be a Kickstarter at the time, the crowdfunding campaign. So, I've known the guy running this, Mike Kennedy, for 5 years off and on. We met at the Tetris World Championship that I hosted in 2010 while he had chased a chuck wagon or just gotten Game Gavel, I forget if he made that purchase or not. And I saw him at a couple of video game meetups outside of L.A. I've written for the Retro Magazine. I don't write for anymore. I decided not to anymore, but I've written for 4 issues of that. So, no Mike Kennedy. I just spoke with Mike Kennedy at Game On Expo about the Retro VGS for like 15 minutes, and I'll get into more of the details later. So they launched their Kickstarter, and it went south fairly quickly.
Yeah, I mean, the backlash was almost immediate.
So there's a lot of things we can discuss here, but let's start with, I guess, the campaign itself and what the Retro VGS is.
So the Retro VGS launched, and the Kickstarter is looking for close to $2 million.
The Indiegogo.
The Indiegogo.
And there's a distinct difference, so we'll get to that. Why.
There's a reason why we need to make that clear. The Indiegogo.
Indiegogo is also a crowdfunding platform, if you didn't know.
The Retro VGS bills itself as a return to the roots of retro gaming. There is a heavy, heavy emphasis on the usage of cartridges, and cartridges being a superior media because they allow for instant play, and cartridges do not require updates.
And you can put them on, instantly play them.
Right. The system is made using a machine tooling for Atari Jaguar cases that was acquired, and the cartridges would come in Atari Jaguar cartridge cases as well. The system was initially built to play games developed specifically for the Retro VGS using its own internal architecture, and B, to play your retro games from various systems using a field programmable gate array, which is essentially a circuit board that reconfigures itself on the fly based on its needs to handle various situations. So, if a Nintendo cartridge was in there, it would play the Nintendo cartridge.
If you had an adapter.
It would require a separate adapter. If you used a separate adapter and put a Neo Geo cartridge in there, it could also play that by reconfiguring.
It could figure out what it was and say, all right,
basically,
this is a Super Nintendo game.
Yes.
We have the coding inside for this.
Let's
do it.
Do this on the fly, and we got it. So that was what it. That's what it is billed as, and it's ostensibly, and I'll get into this more later, it is ostensibly sold towards retro game aficionados who want something new that is old.
Okay, real quick though, that FPGA part of it, which is the field programmable gate array, one of the reasons why that was people liked the idea is because then you could then develop for that a lot easier using the system too.
Sure.
So you can develop a ColecoVision game using, I guess, a dev kit with this, or a Nintendo game even, that was sort of part of the appeal.
It was supposed to make development a whole lot easier, in addition to being a nice cherry on top of a sundae in terms of letting you play your old stuff. The system was originally slated to be about 150. Then they said about 180. Then they said maybe 200. Problematically, the Indiegogo has the lowest system price at $299, which I think is the first problem that a lot of people had, among many.
Plus shipping.
I'm going to get there. Plus shipping, which is $40 within the continental U.S. and $70 for outside of the U.S. I have to state that that is a lot for shipping. A well-padded and packed priority flat rate box that will get you an item in 2 days is about $20. There are also a number of tiers for people who would like to purchase, pay more. You can get a personalized system. You can get a system in a bronze color. You can get a system in a silver color. You can get a system in a gold color. You can essentially bid on getting the first serial number.
And these are a lot more.
These are like much more.
$424 for the silver, $450 for the gold, $500 for the elite one, which is the serial number that you basically bid on to get the higher one.
So you're talking $150 more for a color that is limited. Here's one issue that I have with the system. It's built as a system for retro game enthusiasts. Yet the price point and everything that has been announced so far, I feel like it preys on a retro game enthusiast. This is not for someone who enjoys playing retro games. This is for a collector, and it is for a collector only. Why? Because the Indiegogo fails to state what the processor is going to be, what any of the specs are going to be. It has no working prototype as of right now, which is why they used Indiegogo. Kickstarter requires a working prototype for hardware. So what they are selling you is a dream, yet they are more concerned with you bidding on a high serial number and getting a fancy color console than they are actually showing you what the thing can do. Now let's back up. The thing that they show on the page, the sizzle reel for the games, that is games being played on a PC largely, or a system where these games have already come out on.
Well,
why?
Yeah.
Because of what I just said. The games for this system are almost exclusively not exclusive. I mean, these are games that were indie titles released on Steam or Dreamcast. And there's more problems with that I'll get into later. But right there is your first issue. Why is someone going to pay what I feel is an exorbitant amount of money, and then an exorbitant amount of money for the cartridges? A lot of these are between $30 and $60 for a game that you can play on your PC hooked up to your TV for $10.
Yeah. To tie us back to our conversation we had last time about cartridges, about why could they ever come back? One of the reasons why we said they couldn't, besides the price, is that it's just an outdated way of making games.
Yes.
One of the selling points of this system is that you're going to get a game in a cartridge bug-free. I'm not sure who or what could guarantee that any game would ever be bug-free. When you look back at the NES library of games, there's glitches in those games. They are not bug-free. Even the higher-end games, even a game like Super Mario Brothers, has glitches in it.
You know why someone can beat DuckTales in 7.5 minutes? Because you can glitch the entire moon level.
And those games, these games here, had full QA teams on them.
You have to remember, these had... Yeah, exactly. These were large development studios working on these.
So Legend of Zelda had a team pouring through that game to make sure there weren't any game-breaking bugs in it. When you're talking these modern indie-style retro games being made, these are not large teams by and far. Some of these are a couple people. Some of these are one person. A game like Battle Kid was one of the first NES homebrews to gain popularity. Was done by Civac. One person. So what this means is that they don't have necessarily all the time the means, the resources, and the money to do full QA before a game gets put out there. So when that happens, they may not catch something. So when you have the game, if people start saying, oh, there's a bug here. Oh, this sort of weird scenario that you may not play through the game 10 times to see, this might break the game. Oh, I can now make a change to that game, release a patch to you. You get the patch, it's fixed within a week, maybe less, you're good to go.
Now, people... Oh, sorry.
By having to, by lauding the fact that these games can't be updated, that is not a positive.
No, that's negative.
Because what happens when the packing game has a bug in it, or one of the first launch games has a bug in it, and the players get it and they're disappointed, they're fucked. They're not going to send the games back to get take them apart, reburn the ROM after they do. You're screwed. Or conversely, what would happen then is if a company wants to make sure the game is bug-free, you ain't getting this game for a long, long time. It's going to come out on Steam and PC first. It's going to be a lot cheaper than the $30 to $60 cartridge that this is going to be. It'll be a $10 or $15 game. And you know what? You're going to get the game in February instead of getting it in October.
And it will be updated as things are noted. Now, look, we all hate this update, you know, this release of broken game culture. But I think this really comes with AAA games. Now, one of the things they stated was... Now, Pat's absolutely right. He stated that, you know, these indie teams are small, often, sometimes one person, sometimes a team of 3 to 5. Now, they may not have money for Q&A or time for Q&A, so they do the best they can. Well, the Retro VGS team has stated when asked about this that, well, no, we're going to have rigorous standards standards in place to make sure that the games are bug-free. Well, guess what? The Retro VGS team is 3 people.
Yeah.
So we have a total of 10 people bug testing and in indie game. There's no way you can do this. As Pat had stated before, and as I've stated, these games that came out on cartridges, you have to be looking through extremely foggy, rose-tinted glasses to think that these games were perfect in any way, shape, or form. There's a reason why people can speedrun The Legend of Zelda on Super Nintendo in like 10 minutes. Because there are bugs that you can use to break the game. And that is always going to exist. The other point I want to make, and Pat makes a good one about how it would take a long time for these games to finally hit the market if they're going to put rigorous standards in place, right? But here's my other thing. Games aren't developed this way anymore. If you wanted something like this to happen, even admitting that an occasional bug would come through, you would need a dedicated team of developers creating only games for the Retro VGS, who are willing to sign off when a game is done, nothing else is going to happen to it, and if they want to do more, there will be a sequel or something else. However, that's not the case. Why? No one is going to write a game only for the Retro VGS. There's no money in it, and that's a lot of labor. If these people decide that, because it happens, if an indie game developer releases a game, and it does really, really well, okay, and they decide they want to thank the fans, and they update with a little bit of additional content or something like that, well, guess what? Your really awesome, unupdatable, no patches necessary cartridge isn't going to fucking get that shit. And then you're going to get people who wondered why they spent $60 on a game that can't get the bonus content that was released after the small-time indie dev said, thanks, here guys, I did this for you. Even if it's charged, but sometimes it's not charged, these people aren't going to get the thank you. They're going to end up with a portion of a game on a... And they specifically go through and tell you what every color of the cartridge is going to be because it's collector-minded, not player or gamer-minded. You're going to have X game on a translucent red cartridge on your shelf when the person who just bought it on Steam is going to have a much fuller game, and it's just not on cartridge.
The cartridges cost money. We talked about why. These are going to be like opening up a Nintendo game. These aren't going to be like a little flash thing in it, you know. The Retro VGS team are going to be producing these carts. This is going to be the NES model where the game publisher sends their game to get produced, and then they take a cut of the cost,
right,
and then sell them. That's how this would work. You know, I forget exactly what Mike told me at a game on Expo about the cut they're taking, but it's at least, I think, around $10 they would take. So, like the NES, the exact same thing. They will control the selling of it and get a cut of each cartridge, and that's how they'll probably make their money in the long term, because since I don't think Retro VGS would have their own first-party games or something like this. Let's talk about the controller ports and the controller.
Oh, geez.
So what's going to be featured here, in theory, on the Retro VGS, by the way, which was going to think it have HDMI output and have S-video and have also composite. It was going to have maybe one other one. I think maybe RGB compatibility or something. That's not important to me right now. What's important to me, though, is controller ports. This is why. So they're going to feature two USBs, two 9 pins, which you would see on an Atari or Genesis, which to me is cool because that means you could plug a Genesis controller in, yes, theory and play a game. And it's really cheap to throw those on there, apparently, since everyone's doing it. But the USB could be cool because you can get adapters for USB to use whatever you want. But the Retro VGS packing controller, let's talk about that real quick. The Retro VGS packing controller is a third-party Wii
U Pro controller.
Wii U Pro controller.
With poor reviews.
That you can buy right now on, I think, Amazon or whatever, for like $12 or whatever it is.
Yes.
You have analogs, you have...
four face buttons and triggers. I think four triggers.
You know, it's what you'd expect from any controller at this point. So it's not getting good reviews. I guess they're going to include that there. I don't have a lot to say about that, except that if you're going to get an off the market controller, why even bother at that point to include it? If it's one that's not well reviewed, if it's one that isn't unique, I'm not saying come up with your own controller. What I'm saying, though, is if you're going to go and source a third-party controller, get one that's good.
If you've got two USB ports and two 9-pin ports, ship it out without a controller. I hate to say it, but you can assume that someone who's buying this has got a Genesis controller or a USB controller laying around that they can use, instead of you pretending like you have a proprietary controller that you're selling for like $25.
Yeah, it's weird because if they're buying these in bulk, they're getting a sweet deal on these. If these are retailing for $12... Even if they're getting one specially done, they ain't paying more than $5 each for these controllers in bulk.
Now, believe me, I know controller pricing. They're not.
So
that stuff.
To call it a prototype in any way is sort of...
No, it's 100% disingenuous. It's not a prototype. It's an off-the-shelf controller that you silkscreen something onto.
Well, let's talk about the goal of it. The 2 million goal. They had a breakdown of the costs involved, which I'm not going to get into. I don't care how much that you're paying each other. I don't care. I care about the fact that there's no prototype, and I care about the cost of the prototyping. It's not cost anywhere near $2 million to build a prototype.
Nope. As a matter of fact,
because if this Indiegogo campaign doesn't go through, and right now it's at $67,580, 3% funded. With 4 days in, it's not going to get funded unless a millionaire comes through with no business sense and a lot of money to burn, comes in and dumps it.
And then we'll have 160 people with these consoles who can sit around and talk about how great their gold one is.
Okay. So, you threw me off. Whole point is this, is that if they meet their goal, then they'll do the prototype. Right. Which, again, is kind of strange just because the prototype can be done for far, far less than what they're claiming. Mm-hmm. That's the problem, which we'll get into a second. But again, that's why they had to switch from Kickstarter to Indiegogo. And this sort of blew up on the Atari Age forums. So we brought up a name before on the show, his online handle of Kevtris. And we brought him up because he's the guy who, turns out, was doing the HDMI NES boards to throw into the analog NTs when they couldn't figure out how to do the external adapter. So we just brought up his name the last podcast, the one before.
I feel like the guy's a robot with his capabilities and his production rate.
He seems like he's the guy to go to for this stuff.
For sure.
So he was in talks, and Kevtris revealed this on the Atari Age. It's like 85 pages long.
He revealed it right after the Indiegogo because he felt like he had to say something.
He had to say something. He felt weird. Because he was, I guess, originally involved with the project. He was the guy providing the FPGA board. So he was the guy that was going to be responsible for all the cores for doing all the retro systems. And he has a list on Atari Age of all the ones completed. And he has
RCA Studio 2.
He has, like, RCA Studio 2. Besides, like, the ones, like, oh, yeah, he'll do Atari 2600 and ColecoVision. He'll do the
Neo Geo.
But then RCA Studio 2. So talk about completionist when it comes to stuff. So the guy is a mad scientist, I'll just say.
Yeah.
But he knows his stuff, obviously, because his working boards are in the Analog NT right now. So he was going to develop. He was going to be the guy that we developed. And this is up to the PlayStation era was going to be the FPGA board, right? It was going to go up to the PS1
he
era.
He said most PlayStation 1 era stuff.
But you would have got Genesis games, Super Nintendo compatibility, Nintendo, ColecoVision, RCA. It's just silly.
Wataru Supervision.
Was that on the list?
Yes, it was. And I have one, and I don't even have a game for it.
He must have just wanted to challenge himself and take apart a system that no one has.
He just seems like one of those guys who is eternally curious, and is like, can I do it? Yes, I can.
So the point was that he originally was going to be providing the guts of this. Not the ARM part for the more modern indie games, but everything else he was going to be providing, which a lot of people, like you said, were interested in this, was being able to get that retro compatibility and to be able to either play with an adapter or to be able to develop for that.
Yeah,
I want to do a ColecoVision game. I can have a viable system to put them out on without having an old ColecoVision. So it came out, though, that only the major stretch goal of, was it $3.8 million would include the full FPGA?
So basically, this thing was supposed to have essentially the full FPGA in it. But they made, it's only the most basic. Then a slight, but here's the thing, the whole Indiegogo is vague, really vague. I mean, right down to no, they don't even tell you what the ARM processor is. It just says powerful ARM processor. There's a 3 million stretch goal to make it more powerful, and then 3.8 million to make it max power. Like,
it makes it to what they originally promised people.
Right.
So Kev Tris laid it all out on the Atari Age forums, and he basically
it's
said...
It's beautiful.
He laid down all the technical specs about who he's qualified to talk about this stuff. But he revealed to have been backed out, or he backed out because they basically decided not to include the FPGA arm that he was FPGA board that he was developing. And here's the thing, folks, it was done. For the most part, he had not all the systems done, but he had the board done with a good chunk of the systems already completed. He already had programmed that, and that was ready to go.
He did it before he even necessarily knew exactly what they wanted from him. He did it for fun. And it took him... This is how he did it, and you can read the Atari Age thread on this, but this is great. He got a new circuit board designing program. Taught himself how to use it.
Was it Altrulium?
Atrium. I believe. Taught himself how to use it. Designed his board. Prototyped, I believe it was 6 of them. Had 6 of them done up. Bought, which cost him about $1,200. Bought about $500 worth of additional components to populate the board. And had 6 working prototypes of his FPGA, I believe from Neo Geo all the way, or roughly PSX, all the way down to RCA Studio 2 and Wataru Supervision for $2,000.
So he basically had the large majority of the quarter of what you would consider the guts of the retro VGS was finished. Besides the ARM core, because that's separate.
Right.
But he had everything else done and the basic guts of what this would look like.
Let's just be totally fucking ludicrous and assume that, because basically at that point, once the FPGA is done, they're building a PC, right? So let's just be dumb. Let's just be really dumb and say that costs $20,000, okay? So that's $22,000 for a prototype of this machine. Mm-hmm. And they're claiming it's going to take them hundreds of thousands of dollars to enter the very expensive and lengthy prototyping process.
Just to enter the prototyping process, not to just do what Kev Tris does and just do one in his house.
So what are they fucking selling besides smoke and mirrors? I mean, at this point, I don't know. I mean, because here's the thing. He came out and explained all this and backed out of the project. So now they're left without the FPGA that they were holding ransom as a stretch goal. They don't even have it. They're going to have to find someone else. So what do they have besides a Jaguar case with a fake circuit board inside it? They have nothing.
Well, that's the problem. I don't know if they didn't want to... Kev Tris was going to license the core to them and I guess help out. And then I guess once Kev Tris posted this stuff on the forum, Mike Kennedy basically said, well, I guess you don't want to do business with us anymore. And so... He was officially gone.
I think he was gone before that, but yes, officially done.
But Kev Tris also revealed that he was warning this team of 3 doing his project about all these things that were just not going in the right direction for. For months, he was in contact. according to catchers, and trying to advise them on, okay, this is a good idea to do this. You should do this to these. Build the boards in China. It's a lot cheaper. Use these parts. This is why you should use these parts. This is a guy who has a lot of experience on this stuff. This guy's put out, we just said, he threw 500 of these boards into the analog NT that he made, of the NES HDMI board. This guy knows what he's doing. He's put these products out in the past.
The problem is you've got a guy who has a passion for this, trying to explain this to people who are only worried about how much they can charge more for a translucent blue shell on a system in a limited edition. They don't give a shit.
So Kevtris basically laid it all out. He laid down the costs for the prototype of this system. Again, not including the ARM part or ARM part for the modern games, but that's not going to probably cost as much as what Kevtris already put together. You know, that's probably the least of the concern. So we're talking bad business decisions. And Ian said, who is this product for? I don't know. I don't know what developer will want to develop for this. I honestly don't. Because, again, the profit margin they make isn't going to be great compared to the timing ain't going to be great versus getting it out for a digital download version or Steam where you can put it out next month versus getting the cartridge produced and doing, the extra QA, which could take forever.
And
I don't know.
And if you're a solid indie developer with a good reputation, you don't want to either spend the rest of your life working on a quote-unquote bug-free version of a game to come out for a system no one owns, or you don't want to put something out and trust that between your QA team and their QA team of three people that it's going to be good enough, and then have it be bug-filled, and then their reputation takes a hit when they can just put it on Steam and if they need to fix the problem. Not everyone is an Evil Empire AAA developer who's just rushing something to market. There's a reason why we allow for bug updates in video games, and we have since the 90s on PC.
And if you're a consumer, ask yourself, why are you buying this system? Why? There's not a lot of you. I know that at this point. There's like 160-something. But why are you... Like, what... Most of these games aren't exclusive. You can get them elsewhere. These are not games that are to come out... They're not going to be, you know, games that... Okay, let's play it this way. If there was a Shovel Knight game of that caliber and excellence being made, why would you shoot yourself in the foot and only put it on a console like this with a limited market versus putting it everywhere? You wouldn't.
And here's the thing. A lot of people wanted Shovel Knight to be on this, but you know what just happened? Shovel Knight just released free DLC to thank the fans. If you had the cartridge, you'd be fucked. You know, I mean, back to what I just said prior. It's just, it's stupid.
Your best case scenario would be that you'd have to wait years to get a game. Like, say Shovel Knight came out right now. We're talking September. You know,
are we talking Shovel Knight or Tiny Knight?
Shovel Knight.
Okay,
Let's stick with a game that has been just... Everyone loves
lauded and has free DLC. Okay.
So we're talking a game that comes out right now. This team is making money hand over fist. A game that gets excellent reviews everywhere. People love the game. Hell, it's freaking... people want it to be an amiibo, for God's sake. You know, they're trying to vote for it.
No, it's already an amiibo.
Oh, well, there you go.
It's officially announced.
Okay, we're talking the biggest indie game, like a Super Meat Boy game possible. At what point do they say, you know what, here's a system that even a few thousand people have. We're going to then take our time to port to here and then deal with this whole other outside process to maybe sell to maybe half of the people that own the system are going to buy the game.
So 60.
So I'm saying if a few thousand people bought this. So then, because when people buy a system, the NES launched with 15 titles. Not everyone bought those 15 or 16 titles when it launched. You're buying a few titles. So unless you're the type of person that's going to spend $60 on each and every game that comes out in the system, if you're a developer looking at this, you're not going to just limit yourself to that small market and then deal again with all the bullshit of having to have a cut taken out by the Retro VGS team to produce it, having to make sure you put out the product that's bug-free, whatever the hell that means, since that doesn't exist, and then make sure that everything goes right since you're not handling the distribution of it. You know, like... I don't know. I just don't know. I'm not trying to dogpile. I'm trying to go through the process of why you want this system. Why?
It's not a dogpile. The problem is they created this sort of dogpile situation for themselves. I'm not trying to be overly harsh. I'm simply, you and I are simply stating the facts objectively, looking at this and how crazy of an idea this is. I have no idea who thought that this should actually be launched right now.
I hate to say it, but when these Jaguar, when the mold was bought, because we know the big story is that, well, they use it as dental camera. Like, Atari sold some of their molds to a company that used them. Like, you look online, there's pictures of this white hanging Jaguar unit, which is like a dental camera.
Right.
It's the strangest freaking thing you've ever seen.
Sure.
So, I'm just going to throw this out there. And this is the where I'm hopefully going to end this at. If these Jaguar system molds weren't available for sale, would the Retro VGS ever have existed?
I agree with you on this. I don't think they would have, because the way they talk is every time they're asked about the Atari Jaguar molds, they say it's saving us considerable money. It's almost like they bought an Atari Jaguar mold, injected it, and said, that's an almost complete system. And it's not. You work from the board up.
So did they say, I have a cool idea since I have these shells, and by the way, they have been selling, you know, to the astute, I'm not going to make fun of the Atari Jaguar community, but there's not a lot out there of you, but selling molds, translucent molds to them, that's fine, make your money, do whatever you want. But was this a case of, alright, I have a dream now, I have a shell of a game console, and now let's fill it with something, not sure what to fill it with. Let's go. And again,
hopes and dreams.
It's not like the Nintendo Wii U started with their shell. It's not like the NES started with the shell. They started with, here's the processor, here's the games we can do with it. The shell's the very last thing you worry about at that point.
I do want to finish on one more note, too, because I think that we've had a couple questions about this, and it's the direction the Retro VGS turned in. Now, I'm not sure the Retro VGS actually turned into a direction, but it was the initial expectations. When they announce a cartridge-based system, and they call it the Retro VGS, I think a lot of people were expecting Super Nintendo, Nintendo, Genesis-style games being released again on a system that would take them back to those days. And that's not what they got. What you ended up getting was a computer with sort of emulation.
In theory, if you get it.
Yeah, if you get it. You end up with a computer that runs indie games and potentially does other systems. Kevtris, I think, was the one who made an interesting point. What they needed to do here is they needed to make a modern system with a good processor, but present limitations that were around during the Super Nintendo and Genesis era, so people produced games that were believably retro. And that's not what you're getting at all. Not in any way, shape, or form.
So instead, what you potentially are getting without the FPGA core, you're getting an OUYA with cartridges.
And no online support.
So if you want to contribute to the campaign, go for it.
You'll get your money back.
I honestly don't have ill wishes on people's business ventures, but this one I think was just misguided from the start, and I'm not sort of shocked at all about where it is.
No.
All right. So speaking of other indie gaming retro ish fun
and bad decisions, Mighty Number 9's demo was delayed, and so Mighty Number 9 has had a real rocky road. I like Rocky Road.
I love the TV show. Remember the Rocky Road TV show?
Since announced. It's been delayed a number of times. It was supposed to come out, I believe, this year in the summer. It got delayed until, or maybe the fall. It was delayed until next year. Then they were going to release another demo. I think it was on September 15th. And then they didn't really mention anything when it didn't come out. And then when backlash got strong, they mentioned something about it recently, about it not coming out, and they apologized. To me, the apology rings kind of hollow. Because if you really were sorry, you would have said something on the day that you told everyone it came out. This company is not doing anything to curry the favor of gamers. They, even though Mighty Number 9 was delayed, they still launched another Kickstarter before this game was finished.
For what was the other one?
Red Ash
or something?
Yeah, fuck me.
It was supposed to be like a Red Ash. Like a Mega Man
Legends
type of game?
It's a Mega Man Legends 3, basically. And
trying to do all those in one fell swoop, all those games that Capcom canceled.
Well, so, you know, they tried to do that, which pissed a lot of people off.
That failed, right?
Well, it failed, and then a publisher stepped in and said, we'll take care of this for you. Because people want to see that game happen, but people are pissed. People are pissed because this game, Mighty No. 9, which I'm not saying it's easy because it's not, but it's a 2D platformer that plays in the Mega Man... 2.5D platform that plays in the vein of Mega Man games because it's made by one of the co-creators of Mega Man, Keiji Inafune.
And it's been 2 years since the Kickstarter, right?
And like I said, it got delayed again. So I don't have a whole lot more to say about it, but this is not a good start for a company. And they haven't exactly been kind. When people bring criticism, especially the U.S., team gets very, very defensive, and it's just not breeding any sort of goodwill. I don't know what to say. I mean, other than what I've always said is, you know, look at your expectations for when something is going to be released, or when something is going to happen, or when you're going to have a project, and then expand on it. Like throw it into the future so that you can shoot for earlier.
Well, it seems like part of the problem, I guess they wanted to originally have DRM on the demo because it's supposed to be exclusively for the backers.
But there was a lot of backlash because the last demo was timed as well, and people were like, no, I paid into this. Why are you telling me I can only have it for a certain amount of time?
I really think you're going to like run out after a week or something?
I think it was like a couple weeks or a month.
Why would you do that for a demo?
Because they're dumb. They're not listening. I mean, they're really anti-consumer.
I'm going to release a movie trailer, but you only can watch it for a week.
It's like, you know, they raised so much money for this game because of people's excitement for another Mega Man-style game, and they've just been fucking dicks about it. And so they announced that the new trailer was going to come out, and once again, it was going to be a timed trailer that you only had access to.
Why?
People flipped out, and now they're saying that the delay is because they're trying to work the DRM out of it. And I just...
Well, that's what they said in their statement.
So, I mean, that's where we're at. I just don't understand how long it would take to be like, okay, we're just going to cut off the DRM. Now they say they have to find a new distribution method. I don't know why. Steam doesn't require DRM, which is where they were going to go through. Now they're going to do Humble Bundle. But why the change? Why the unnecessary step? I'm sure someone in the comments will tell me, but Steam does not require DRM. I mean, you download it through them, and then you go offline, and as long as it doesn't require an update, you can play it.
What are they afraid of? What would be the fear of putting out a demo without DRM? Does they spread it around to more people? I mean, that would be the fault of the people that backed it. I mean, if people want to be the exclusive club, you're still going to get it first, and then if someone decides if they can somehow copy it and give it to someone else...
Well, if it's because of piracy, the truth is...
But it's a
get
demo!
Demo! But still, it's supposed to be an exclusive demo. But the fact of the matter is, if piracy is what you're worried about, you need to get the fuck over it. Piracy has existed since forever. Okay?
They made $3.8 million!
Yes. If someone wants to take that game and send it off to someone else, you know what? Suck your own dick. It's what happens. It's just you have to deal with
it. They made $3.8 million, and they'll probably make that again when they actually release the game.
Timing it and being this overprotective and this defensive and this weird about it is... Dude, honestly, I gotta be honest. Like, I wanted this game when it was announced, and watching how they've behaved with it, I kind of don't give a fuck anymore. I mean, will I actually play it? Yeah, maybe. But, I mean, as of right now, I have no interest in giving this company money.
I just think... I actually have less of a problem them doing... If they actually had the resources to do this Red Ash game on the side, I know a lot of people had a problem with that. If they had the resources to do it on the side, I don't have a problem if they hire a new team. I don't know what their development sort of flow is. I don't care. But to DRM a demo is just, what the fuck?
Oh, sure. It's ridiculous.
Oh, my God.
It's fucking stupid.
Like, yeah, let's have less people be interested in your game. You know.
Well, that's exactly what's happening to me. I am less interested now than I was before.
Treat it like a movie trailer. You want as many people as possible to see
it. Oh, wait. No, hold on, though. They could treat it like a movie trailer in WB terms and be like, we really wanted this to be exclusive only to the people at Comic-Con. Because don't like excitement
We haven't talked about any DC or Zack Snyder's for a good 6 weeks now, almost. So
I wasn't talking about them. I was talking about WB.
All right, well,
that's different.
We're veering.
Shush. Let's veer into the next topic.
Let's go into another GameStop conspiracy.
Right.
For retro game conspiracy.
Because we're just making this up because they're taking all my money away.
You're taking all of Luna Video Games' money away.
You fucking tools. So
don't attack my audience here.
I'm only attacking the ones that are attacking
That's
us.
True.
Broken Genesis via GameStop. So a guy who I'm not going to mention his name because I don't want him to get a lot of shit for
well,
this. But
it's public. You
sure.
can find it if you want to. It's on Twitter.
It is. It's all over. So I'll just name his first name though. His name is Cristiano, and he's a guy who's been in contact with me over Twitter for a while. And I think he's kind of made this story known elsewhere, so it's fine. He is just kind of, you know, sending a story our way about GameStop and their quality assurance. So he ordered a Genesis from the from GameStop, a Sega Genesis. And, you know, it was claimed to be refurbished. It was claimed to come with AV cables. And what he received was a Genesis with...
Model 1. Right?
A Model 1 Genesis. With an AC port that has a large chunk missing out of it,
the whole corner,
yep.
of the console.
Oh yeah, the whole corner's gone. a broken controller pin, which
one of the pins is in half.
Which before people jump on us about conspiracy, that's a big thing that you have to know to look for when you buy and sell Genesis systems. I check all of them. People bend the fuck out of the pins all the time because Genesis controllers had very, very tight controller port or controller sockets for the most part. So, I mean, that is something that can happen. Yeah. So it's got a visibly bent pin.
Bent or broken off?
Well, I believe it was just half broken or pushed
in. Either way, you can't use it.
Right. But the biggest... That's big.
You can't use it, the controller.
That's huge. I mean, generally with a little bit of needle nose, you can fix that. The venting on it is cracked and shattered in certain parts, but what I find to be...
Hysterical. And egregious.
But the most damning part of what GameStop claims they are doing in terms of training their employees is... There's a fucking GameStop warranty void if removed sticker over the expansion port for the fucking Sega CD. And it's clean as day. This is not lifted. This is not peeled.
It's a hologram sticker.
It's right there.
Go ahead and produce your own hologram GameStop sticker and counterfeit and see how much cost it would be.
Hit me with your fucking conspiracy theories, because this is insane. So, I mean, there is a happy ending. He took it back to a local GameStop. They credited him back, and they ordered him another one, and he's hoping that, you know, the next one is going
to
be in good shape.
He took it to a store, right?
Yeah, he took it to a store with the packing receipt and, you know, exchanged it. But, I mean, I don't want to dwell on it for too long, but, like,
Jesus
all the
Christ.
Other shit is bad. But, like, seriously, you put the void if removed sticker on the expansion port? Okay. So on a lot of modern systems, they will put the warranty stickers on something that shouldn't be removed. So like if you look at a 360, for instance, they slap it on the inside where you pop the tabs to pull the casing off so they can tell. If you are hiring people to quote-unquote check, test, and refurbish these, which you obviously aren't doing well if there's three other broken things on here, and they don't know that that removable door simply leads to an expansion bay, you have fucking failed at your job.
Yeah, and didn't this guy say he wanted to try it with a Sega CD?
Oh, yeah, he said he has a Sega CD and he wants to hook it up to it, and he fucking can't. So that's why he returned it. He said, I mean, that's how he noticed it. He flipped it over to fucking unhook the door so he could put his Sega CD on it.
At least test that.
And there's a goddamn warranty sticker on it. So, I mean, that also, to me, states that they never tested that port.
Oh, my God. So, you assume that port's going to work.
You do, but I mean...
I'm not going to give him flack for that. I'll give him flack for the fucking warranty void sticker on it.
Fair enough. I mean, because we don't test every Sega CD port, but I'm just saying, with all the fucking bullshit they've shoved down our throat, I mean, come on. Really?
I'll take this time to just go back to, because I've actually have updated information, believe it or not, on the Chrono Trigger debacle.
More?
Yes.
Okay.
I've been busy with a lot of projects. The book's still going on.
Well, because we talked about it 2 weeks ago.
And more, as a dude would say, shit has come to light.
Okay.
There's information I received via email.
Multiple facets and angles. Okay.
Lots of ins, lots of outs. going on. I'm like the dude now with this fucking Chrono Trigger GameStop story. Got an email. Didn't have time to even look up and really research it more, but a guy claims that he got that Chrono Trigger with the fake label and Madden before and had sent it back.
I mean...
And he sent a couple of pictures, I guess. I can look it up right now. I didn't want to bring it up because I wanted to make sure, but we can't do a full topic on it, but there's an outside shot that fake counterfeit Chrono Trigger went through GameStop's hand, went to a guy, went back to them, and then came back again to someone else.
So, I will believe the Genesis.
Allegedly.
I will believe the Genesis. I'll believe the original Chrono Trigger story, and I will allegedly believe this story.
It's an alleged story that...
At this point...
fuck. Let's put it this way. If a third person gets that Chrono Trigger, then all bets are off. I'll just say that. So, again, this isn't us trying to just... I'm not going after GameStop because it's good for my health, but it's consumer protection in a way.
Well, yeah, exactly. I don't think people don't realize that I am. We are two stores, okay? GameStop doesn't fucking affect me.
I don't get lunar residuals, by the way,
I'm not railing against GameStop because it affects my business at all. It doesn't.
Ian gives me tougher deals, I think, sometimes because he knows me, believe it or not.
GameStop affects my business currently 0%. What is this? You should be goddamn happy we bring this shit to light, because otherwise... It's what you should learn to expect. And yes, lots of people have had good experiences so far, but if we don't point this shit out, if we don't point out that GameStop is a bag of shit and is lying to you, I don't know what to say.
Here's the email about the guy. I won't say his name, but in big capital letters, I bought the same one mentioned in your videos. And then the second email he sent me, and I apologize, we could have made it another topic. I'm getting lightheaded because it's funny as hell. He sent me 3 JPEGs with the return label going back to GameStop. What's the other one? The return label that says, let me flip this around here counterclockwise. He bought 3 games. He bought a Castlevania. Castlevania 3 for NES. He bought a Chrono Trigger. And he bought a Pilot Wings. It looks like he might have used a code to get it cheaper. This is only $68. He might have found a 15% off code. So that was that image. And this third image was the return label of it going back with the packing list. And he just sort of canceled out, I guess, his shipping address. But it's a real packing list. So there's a chance, maybe even a 10% chance, probably an 80% chance, maybe a 90%, that fake Chrono Trigger went back to GameStop more than once.
My buddy just bought Mega Man 7 and X3 from GameStop just to kind of see.
Why? Would he risk it?
Because he can return it if it's shit. I think he just wants to see what's going to happen.
The GameStop stop. Retro game return of the week.
All right, time for Q&A.
That first topic I decided not to do is I'm tired. Well, that's not a Q&A.
No, we'll do it later. I'm tired too. From Dave Van Dam Net. Good name. PewDiePie is going to be on Late Show. PewDiePie. Between him and YT YouTubers being on Kimmel, does this mean TYers? YouTubers will soon be mainstream.
No, because when you these are different media. So unless there's a way for YouTubers to make money by being on TV, there's no reason for them to be on TV.
Yeah, it's a different type of media in terms of how it's consumed, and I think they're making more of that money now on YouTube than they would on TV.
Well, no, you're always going to have heavy advertising money still going to be on TV, but they're supplementing that, putting their shit on YouTube.
Okay, fair.
Let's put it this way. It's a different audience. So Jimmy Kimmel is doing his sort of Saved by the Bell reunion skit, knowing that, wow, if this goes on YouTube, it'll go viral. I'll get 5 million views on this. I can maybe get eyes on the TV show, you know. But there's no reason not to do YouTube and have a TV show if you're late night. There's absolutely, because the short interview basis and skit basis make it perfect. But what it's saying, though, is on TV, we want to get that audience from YouTube to come in.
Gotcha.
We get PewDiePie, PewDiePie's got whatever it is, 40 million people throughout the world. Maybe we'll get a small fraction. Maybe we'll get 1 million. And honestly, you'll probably get less than that that will watch the TV show. Those kids, those 12-year-olds, don't know what a TV is. They don't know what a late-night show is. They're going to wait for it to go on YouTube the next day and watch it. And then they'll see it. Either way, the late-night show, the late show, will get exposure. You know, either way.
So YouTube is not going to go mainstream in terms of TV. However, TV will use YouTube to try to bring people back to TV.
Yeah, come back. It's gone, though, but come on back. You know, we'll pretend we know what's going on with. We'll pretend we'll know what a video game is from 25 years ago and whatever else. We'll pretend what this technology is.
All right. Next. At Kagetsudo, do you feel like game collecting is too cutthroat? I lost motivation for game hunting due to it feeling like a competition.
Most collecting markets are cutthroat. I've seen it at the swap meet. Hell, there's guys that like Matchbox cars. I used to hang out with a guy that tried to explain to me about the different Matchbox cars, the red lines, even the limited editions, and it's the same. People are all the same. They just like different things. That's what it comes down to. You're always going to have people that are way competitive about what they collect, or they're cutthroat in how they do business, or how they try to screw people over in comic books, and probably records even.
Oh, yeah. Trying to get the record.
So it's no different in game collecting. So you have to know that going into any collector's market that there's going to be competition, especially now when, in the past, we'll even say 5 years, it's quadrupled the amount of people, if not quintupled the amount of people getting into retro games. You know, like, it's just so much more. So you're going to expect it to be more competitive, just trying to find less and less out there. Now, I will say this, though. A lot of the cutthroat, though, are the people that come in, the speculators, and I would call them the profiteers, that come in just to screw everyone else over and then, you know, treat it as a business first and foremost, and only, and that's it. That's where a lot of the cutthroat part sort of feeds into everything else. And I think there's a lot of, I don't want to say bad vibes, but the energy, we'll just say, of that kind of maybe can infect the collectors. Maybe I'm being too dramatic when it comes.
No,
you know,
I don't think I don't so. Know. Because what I would say is this. I mean, I did not leave collecting as, like, serious collecting because it was cutthroat. Like you said, it's in everything. I left collecting because I hit a burnout and I was getting priced out of that hobby. However, I do feel like Pat's right. It's going to be like that in any collecting market. However, I feel like the personality and the general vibe among different collecting markets can vary greatly. I do feel like video game collecting right now is very, very shady's not the word. Slimy on occasion is more the word I'm looking for. There's a lot of shit going on with video game collecting that drives me nuts that I don't see in record collecting.
It's a lot of secrecy. It's a lot of backdoor shit you never see or you just hear about in terms of, I don't know if there's a lot of price manipulation going on in records, I don't know, but I hear stories that are told by me by multiple people about stuff that goes on. Where it's like, oh, it's just, you look at, then you see that same person that gets accused of it, and you're just like, yeah, I could see it.
So I can say this. You know. In records, there are definitely people who are profiteers, people who buy up stuff and they want to sell it for more money. But there's a lot less of that secret, backdoor, shady shit going on.
Are there people that corner the market with games or try to?
You mean records? Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there is. I'm not going to say there isn't. In my experience with what I look for, no, not really. The thing is records were produced in humongous amounts. So there's also not that same limited availability.
They weren't a lot of them thrown out, though, from the 60s and 70s, though, still?
You still find them. I mean, whether they're in good shape or not is different. But all I'm saying is even if they're trying to get more money than they should for a record, I find that the people in record collecting, just for an example, are a lot more upfront than
and
video
maybe
game.
In a record store, they won't move as quickly.
Yes.
True. There's a lot less record collectors. So maybe that same Beatles album will sit there for 6 months versus less than a week.
Well, and no one's trying to get money for a Beatles album unless they're dumb because they're all over. But yeah,
it's the first old group I thought of that Frank loves and you hate. That's the only reason I'm throwing it out there. And Frank will never let you forget that.
No, he won't.
And probably never respect you because of that. No, I'm kidding. Frank still wants you over for dinner. He open invite any Sunday.
Let me know when he's making sweet sausage and sauce again.
Oh, and meatballs? He hasn't done that in a while. That's more of a... If he likes... You know what? traditionally for the playoffs. When the playoff starts,
okay.
For some reason, it's the weirdest thing. It's like, yeah, when playoff starts, he'll make like 4 pounds of sauce and meatballs and
sausage. I love spicy, but whatever he did, whatever sausages he used, when he did that sweet sausage in his sauce, holy shit.
Was that the last time you came over? That was like 2.5 years ago.
No, it wasn't the last time, but it was definitely one of the more memorable times.
You haven't been over Frank's in like 2 years. It's been a long time.
It has been.
Only you are to blame for that, sir.
It's true, but
it hurts Frank's feelings on some level.
It hurts mine, but the only day I have to socialize with people is Sunday.
Well, then Frank socialized with him one Sunday of the year.
Okay. Or I'll have Frank come over and play video games with us.
Yeah, but that'll work out well.
All right. This is another Ian Asks.
way to break down the fourth wall.
At Nate Wilcox 23, was it a bittersweet and
bittersweet?
I know. Was it a bittersweet slash anticlimactic day when you bought the last NES cart and completed your collection?
You know what it was? It was a feeling of, not that I wasted my time, but you expect there to be a bigger reward for that last game purchase. And you can say, well, I don't have stadium events, I don't have the Panesian games, but at the time, I was like, it's done. And I think one of the last games, it wasn't. Bonk's Adventure was in the last 10. It was probably one of the Color Dreams games. Something like Challenge of the Dragon or something. It was probably one of the last ones I got, or Marines of Atlantis. And it was sort of a feeling like, it was an accomplishment, I guess. It's like, wow, this took me like, 12 years to do this.
Right.
I was like, all right. I didn't want to think about the amount of money I spent. You know, I was like, yeah, this is cool. I guess this is an accomplishment. Because in 2010, I completed it, early 2010? Because that's...
You completed
no,
it...
No, early 2009.
Yeah, you completed it before we did the first marathon.
Because when I bought the NWC in 2009, they were around the same times.
Yeah.
I think I bought the NWC gray before I completed the collection. I think it was like a month after. It was something like that.
You had a complete collection in time for the first marathon, which was 2010.
Yes. But 2009, I think, is when I completed.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. 2009.
25 years of 2000. The marathon was 2010, the first one. It's 25 years from 85.
Well, then wouldn't 5 years be 2015, which is what it is now? 10, 11, 12, 13,
30. 14. 85, 30. Anyway, so Ian can do the math in his head later, which I don't know how he's not doing it correctly. But the whole point was that...
You did some math horribly the last podcast.
No one knows that. Because they're listening now. Anyway, so it was a feeling of I accomplished something. Honestly, it doesn't mean much. And I say this not to shit on the newer collectors that are coming in, but it just shows that you have a lot of expendable income. That's all it shows, that when you complete a game collection.
Well, because
it shows you have a desire. It shows you have a passion to do it. It shows that you must have a love on some level of the system, but it just shows you have a lot of time.
For me...
And money.
Yeah.
To do it. And for me, it wasn't even a huge amount. Compared to now, sure. No fucking way am I doing it.
Yeah.
The 2010 and before prices, we're talking, you know, half of these games I got probably before 2007 or 2006, and the other half I got after 2006, then that's a big difference between trying to do it now. So I don't know. I don't know your thoughts on this, Ian, besides not being able to count. What are your thoughts?
Fuck off. Basically, I mean, all I can say is I don't have a complete collection of anything, but I have a good Game Boy black and white collection that I love dearly, and just like you don't have quite everything like the Pan-Asian collection games, there's probably like 5 to 10 Game Boy games that I don't have that I want, but basically I reached a point where there was nothing else I wanted with it. So to me, my collection was complete, roughly. And it almost sucks, in my opinion, to complete it because you no longer got that thrill of finding that fun game that you wanted to get. And for me, that's what it's about. Like, I'm not a completionist, so it's like I'm looking for that next really cool game that I've always wanted to own, and I'm at that point now where I'm basically out of those.
Well, honestly, a lot of this, since I found a good chunk of these at the flea markets, that was the high of finding them back when... You know, 2004, 2005, you can find, 40 NES games for $20.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and at that point, you don't care if that there's doubles because in those, there's some new ones that you don't have, and you have trade fodder or whatever else you do with them. You can resell them in 2004 and get a dollar for your extra Ghostbusters cart. So, Yeah, that was a lot. But nowadays, I go out to the flea markets. We can talk about this later, how there's a lot less out there anyway. But I ain't finding, even though I know a guy who found Magical Chase at a flea market, for God's sake, I know there's a chance that I could find a Stadium Events or a Panesian game at the flea market. But it ain't going to happen.
Sure.
It's just not. At David C. Kenyon, why isn't there more love for the Sega Master System? What are some of your favorite games for the system?
Well, I mean, I think there is plenty of love for the Sega Master System.
Proportionate love.
Yeah, I mean, about a year ago, 2 years ago, it kind of became the trendy alternate system to collect for. And then, after about a year, it died down. But there are, I mean, why wasn't there more love? Because no one fucking had it as a kid.
Not in North America. People say, oh, in Europe some people had it. No one in North America had it.
In Europe it was popular, and in Brazil it was insanely popular, but in the U.S., it was like, you know,
2%
the joke is two kids in every high, in every school. You know, two kids in every school had it.
Didn't know anyone.
I knew one kid, really.
I knew one kid on the TurboGrafx, and I don't know if I knew anyone who had a Master System.
I knew one who had both. And he was a shit. but what are some of my favorite games for the system? That's pretty easy. Penguin Land is one that's one of my favorites, and I've said it about a billion times. It's an incredibly creative game, and it's fun as hell. I also really like the Zillion series, and I'm a big fan of Zillion 2, which a lot of people don't think is as good as the first one, because it's not an open Metroid-type game, but it's just a really good action game.
I will go back to why isn't there more love for the Master System besides that 14 people owned it in the U.S.? Because a lot of those games, you can find a better version on the Genesis. You're not going on the Master System to play Shinobi or Outrun.
Sure. Hangover. Hangover.
The Hangover series of Master System
those
games.
Were the best.
Someone please Photoshop that with Ian on it. The Hangover Sega Master System game with Ian's face.
God. Just get the right font, please. I'll be picky about that.
So, yeah. So, those games. I mean, hell, I love Rastan on the Master System.
Yeah.
It wasn't on the Genesis. It's okay on the Master System. It's not nearly as good as the arcade. I wish it was on the
Moonwalker's another example. Like Moonwalker was good on the Master System, much better on the Genesis. Like, I don't know. The Master System definitely had some standalone games that were fun, but they were either available on other systems, like Spy vs. Spy or Rampage, even though Rampage had the wolf character, or they were better done on the Genesis rather quickly, because you got to remember, the Genesis came out in 88.
89.
Early 89 in the U.S., sure.
Summer 89 here.
Okay, fine. I'll just take your word for it.
The whole point was that they gave the Master System less than 3 years before Sega said here in America, we're done with this
exactly.
system. Exactly. After 2 years, we're like, no, we don't. We have this Genesis thing coming out that's already out in Japan.
We're done with this.
So, I mean, at that point, it was dribbling. You know, we're talking... a 2.5 year lifespan before the new system, 3 years, that's really bad. So the only reason I bought it, I don't know if Toys R Us was even carrying it anymore, but Kitty City, the lovable Kitty City, was still carrying him. So when I only had Rampage. Rampage was fun on the Master System. That's a good port of it, I thought. I might have reviewed that for Christmas last year as Pat the NES Punk, the character. Check out that Christmas video. It's fun. Frank's in there. So is Ian.
I am.
You don't remember filming that?
No.
Before Christmas?
Mm-mm.
Remember you were cleaning the cartridge and you materialized in the room?
Oh, right. Sure. Got it.
That was fun times.
Okay. Yeah.
That was the best shoot ever because it only took like 15 minutes.
I'll believe you.
Actually, we had to reshoot it because the sound wasn't on for it. Didn't we?
Oh, yeah. And
I felt horrible because for the one time where it was actually quick, we had to redo it.
Yeah, it was supposed to be like 20 minutes. It ended up taking like 45.
It wasn't 45. It was like a half hour. All right. At Tim A. Johnson. Serious question. Have you ever been bullied for playing and collecting? My fiance calls me a nerd. Are you saying your fiance bullies you?
You know, for all the things I've been bullied for and made fun of when I was a kid, I don't think games was ever one of them. In elementary school... What? Elementary? Fuck off. In elementary school... You know, most of my friends played games. It was a small network, so it was cool to get a new game. It was cool to play a new game. In middle school, I was made fun of for so much shit. Who knows if games were part of it? I don't think so. by the time high school rolled around and I started collecting NES games when I was really into that, People actually thought it was kind of interesting. I mean, maybe they said shit behind my back, but they were like, why is this guy interested in all this old shit? But they were interested. They, you know, they were curious as to how many I had. A lot of people, not just my friends, took interest in how what number I was up to. And a lot of them didn't give me shit for it because it was a quick way for them to make $20. They'd come in with a box of, you know, 30 or 40 games, and I'd just give them $20, and I'd walk off happy. Yeah.
Oh, you're lucky. God, I wish I got into it sooner. I wish I was into it in high school. That would have been great.
No, it was...
Imagine how much I could have got if I started collecting even 3 years earlier.
Dragon Warrior 2, Jesus. 3, and 4, I got in a lot of, like, 30 games for $20.
I could have... If I started collecting... Say I started collecting in 94, 95, I would have had State of Events. I would have got enough of, like... I would have found a Funko Land for $100.
If I had kept up with it and I had it moved out at when I was 18, like, right after high school, and I had actually, like... kept up on collecting, I would have had a full set by 2002, and it wouldn't have cost me nearly a fucking dime.
If I knew I was eventually going to get a full set when I started collecting, I would have done it in, like, probably 2.5 years, because I could have went on eBay and got them all in, like, a year. And, and you know what? It wouldn't have been that much money, obviously. I could have got Same Events for a few hundred, and I could have got the rest. I could have got Bonk's Adventure for $10 or 15, whatever it was, in 2001, you know.
It was 15 fucking bucks up until, like, 2007.
Nine. Six. Nine, even you think?
2008, 2009. Right. Well, I mean, I don't know. Let's see. I moved here in 2005. I was working at Luna by 2007.
I'd say it was like 40
I probably
bucks,
stopped saying. I probably stopped seeing Bonks by 2008 or 9, and it was a $15 to $35 game when it would come in.
Wow. Okay, so anyway, yeah, I never got bullied. I never got bullied for games because everyone had games.
Yeah,
even the bullies had games. Even the jocks, quote unquote, were playing. Games.
We grew up in a time where it wasn't socially a social stigma, then it became one, and then it wasn't again.
I'll just provide this as people have wanted me to do my dating advice show or relationship and life advice. Your fiance, she's probably calling you a nerd in a playful way, I'm guessing, but there's a saying that there's a hint of truth to every joke, so maybe at some weird level she doesn't like it, but hell. Not saying break up with her. There's stuff about your spouse or your girlfriend or boyfriend that you're not going to like everything, and you have to accept it, and that's part of being in love. But if she really is bullying you, I would get out of that. If she's bullying you, slapping you around for, you nerd, you like Nintendo games. All right, next
at
one.
@cow_man.
Cow man.
Any advice for someone attending their first or second retro gaming convention, like, say, Retro Gaming Expo?
Well, it depends. If you're looking to buy stuff, know what you're looking for. Have some sort of objective. You can get overwhelmed. Especially at a convention like Retro Gaming Expo, they literally have everything from console games going back to the early 70s. You can find anything there. Handheld games and computer games, you can get overwhelmed. There's a lot of vendors. There's a lot to look at. So you're going to have a budget, obviously. You're not going to come with a few grand. I don't know what you're going to come with, $500. I don't know. I don't know what your budget is. But have a budget. Know what you're looking for. And if you see a deal, you know, yeah, go for it. But, you know, just have some sort of general direction of what you want to do. And make sure you rest a little bit. It can be, I mean, I'm sort of a manual guy, so Retro Gaming Expo, was it 3 years ago? I bought literally 300 manuals there. And it was exhausting, especially since I had a booth to get back to. It can get tiring. And, you know, check out a panel. Check out maybe the Live CU podcast on Saturday or the Pat Contry panel on Sunday with the Play the Punk Challenge. And maybe I'll reveal a new book project or reveal the, you know, the fundraising campaign there. But anyway, what was I saying? Oh, about the Retro Gaming Expo or any other advice. Any convention at all, though, make sure you bathe. I know that sounds like a cliche thing to say, but there are people that don't take care of their hygiene at conventions. So, that's all. And I don't know. Don't blow on any NES carts. Don't blow on them because it oxidizes them.
My advice would be to stay cool, Tiger.
Saito Kojima, would you guys ever do a CU podcast guide in just about your childhood school experiences? Or childhood experiences in general, I think, would be fun.
I think childhood experiences in general would be fun. I mean...
On this very special CU podcast.
I mean, school was not particularly awesome for me growing up, but I made friends with the right people, and things were not... Things were not as awful as they could have been. I mean, sure, if people wanted us to, I'd sit around and shoot the shit about being a kid, playing games, you know, you know, what school was like, what my neighborhood was like. But,
oh, yeah.
I mean, it's, I guess I don't necessarily understand why you'd want to know that. But, I mean, if you do, I would do it. It's just, I don't know.
Well, maybe it's a different culture. I don't know. Yeah, is that your real name? I don't know if you're from a different culture or maybe.
Well, sure.
You don't know what it's like to grow up in the suburbia America.
Maybe the Northeast is a lot different than the Southwest. I mean, by all means, I'm open to talking about that stuff. I'm open to talking about most things that people ask on the podcast. But I just, you know, I feel like my childhood was, I was a little bit dorkier than average, but, and I got picked on a little bit more than average, but I don't think it's that unique.
I got picked on a lot, but I got over it. I didn't kill anyone. I had a fight in eighth grade. I kind of unfortunately took it out of one kid, but that'll be part of the Gaiden podcast.
Yeah.
Me pummeling a kid in front of the entire school.
You already talked about that a number of times.
On the podcast?
Yes.
Did I really on the podcast?
Yeah.
Someone in the comments tell me if I saw that on the podcast. Really? With the pizza and everything? Okay.
I'm fairly certain he did.
How do you guys feel, this is from at Flosslow, how do you guys feel about a lot of comic movies changing the costume, gender, or race in the movies? I haven't seen them change the gender in the movies yet.
Well, I mean, my thing is this. If as Pat says, the comic books are as unimportant to the movies as he says, I really don't care what they do with the characters. As a comic book fan, I would like them to play it close to the comic book. But honestly, if we are in a reality where comic book movies are viewed by people who do not read the comic books, I don't really give a shit what they do with costumes, gender, or race if the movie is good. You have to realize that there are alternate universes in actual comic books that take this sort of thing into account because they want to explore stories from different angles. That said, me being an actual comic reader who is a fan of comics as they are portrayed, I prefer things to be shown as they are in the comic.
I'm a purist. I want source material respected, otherwise don't do it and do something else. That's as simple as I'm going to say. You read a character like Peter Parker for 60 years, you know him as that character. That's who he is to me. If you want to do a character of a different gender or a different race, create a new character or get one. You know what? You know one of my favorite characters is Falcon. I love Falcon. My favorite Captain America run of comics, and as a kid, I had for the late 60s, early 70s, was Captain America and Falcon. And he's a guy, you get him in the movie, he's a different race, and everyone's happy, I think, at that point. You're not betraying anything, you're not making another character a different race. He's Falcon. That's who he is. He's great. Same with Black Panther. There's no need to go in another direction, I don't think, and just to say, all right, we're going to change this. There's characters that exist there that you can use.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I don't want to see... I know it's a stupid argument because there's far less African-American characters than white, but I don't want to see Luke Cage be a white guy. I love Luke Cage. Keep him like that. And I think the reverse should be true, too. That's just what I feel about that.
I don't think it needs to be a controversial topic at all. I am giving you shit a little bit here for saying that the comics don't matter. But
Marvel doesn't care about the comics. The source material still matters, though.
But source material does matter to me. So if you're going to if you're going to do an X-Men movie, I expect them to behave.
Yeah.
I expect them to behave and look similar to the X-Men. Same thing with anything. That's just how it is.
Yeah, I actually didn't have a problem with something like with Thor when they made Thor a woman. That made sense because the hammer can go to anyone else, you know. So for that, it doesn't.
Yeah, it was a cool turn.
And yeah, that doesn't bother me because that fits with the character.
And with Nick Fury being Sam Jack, it's just pulling from the alternate universe. So
I didn't care.
You're pulling from existing source material, and that's fine.
Yeah, like I said, it's. It's almost, I wouldn't say I'd be insulted. I'm not going to pretend I'm an underrepresented minority. But I almost would be insulted if you couldn't come up with a character to represent me versus just saying, pick one that's popular and switch the race on it. And everything's fine. I'd rather you come up with a character that is cool, that can stand on their own without just being, it's just a black version of Captain America versus going out and getting a cool character like Black Panther and putting him in a movie like that. That's what I'm going to say. I know people are going to hate me for saying that, but that's my...
There's a really sweet alternate cover for an upcoming Black Panther comic where he's putting his mask on like Jay-Z puts his hat on for the Black album. It's awesome.
I don't like Jay-Z that much.
Neither. I don't either, but it's still like a really cool conceptual cover.
I keep forgetting there's going to be like these other weird movies coming out. Like there's going to be a Captain Marvel movie and a Black Panther movie. And hopefully by then we're not going to be superheroed out on it, you know.
I won't be, because that's what I read, but lots of other people might be. All right.
This is from my favorite Twitter handle, That Ass Is My Boss. Is Mario Maker success indicative of a tonal change in gaming culture? Oh, where creating is more important than playing?
No, I don't think so. And there's a couple of reasons why. One, Mario Maker's success is success because it's Mario, and people love the fuck out of Mario. The other reason why we're seeing a lot of people making levels in Mario Maker is because Mario Maker makes it really intuitive and really easy. And even though there's technically four different physics engines that you can use, Mario 1, Mario 3, Super Mario World, and New Super Mario U, the creation is still very, very simple. You're still laying out things on a grid. I mean, Mario mm-hmm. has always been...
It's like Mario Paint.
Right. Oh, there's even somewhere in there, there is the bug tapping game.
Oh, really? They put that in?
I found it somewhere. Awesome. I'm almost positive it was in there. If not, it was on a Wii U game somewhere, but I think it's that one.
That's awesome.
So it's easy to create. You're working with a grid no matter which version which physics engine you're working on. Mario has always existed on a large grid. I don't think it's creating, though, that's making people love it, because if that was the case, then games like Little Big Planet 1, 2, and 3, especially with 3 being out, would have a lot more attention and they'd be a lot more popular. Now, there are millions of Little Big Planet levels out there, but it's not easy to jump into Little Big Planet level creating. Even if you look back at, like, game creation studios on the PC, like Click and Play and Games Workshop, it takes a bit of learning to get into it. With Mario, you just do it.
Yeah.
So what you did is, people bought a Mario game, and they're like, hey, I'm going to play all these crazy Mario levels people are creating. And then they realized how easy it was for them to do it. But you bought a Mario game. I don't think a lot of people bought this simply because there's a tonal change.
No, this is a community game. You can share your levels. Super Mario Bros. Is the most popular platformer ever, perfected the platforming genre and helped establish it. If they put out a Kid Icarus Maker game, it would sell nearly as well. You know, this is Super Mario. This is the game that this was designed for because of its simplicity and the fact that, again, it's like the perfect platformer.
Mm-hmm.
So this hit a sweet spot of both, where I don't think most games you could get away with.
No.
You know, this isn't like, hell, it's not like go back and play the Excitebike edit mode. It's okay, you know, but it's not like you're going to stay up hours designing Excitebike levels.
Right.
You know, so something like Super Mario Brothers, it's just, it's a timeless game.
And it has so many good things in it that with the minor amounts of fucking around that Mario Maker allows with things like the Fireball Wands and Lukitus and letting you, you know, create pipes that spit out coins or Goombas and stuff. There's enough things in there that you can take this very simple framework and make very cool, fun things, but it's still, and here's the main key, it's easy to get started and to do it. There is no learning curve.
And it has that gamepad that people hated, and, well, if you didn't have that gamepad, I doubt you'd be able to sell nearly as many copies because you can just literally go, woo, with your little...
The gamepad. You know what? Without the gamepad, you wouldn't have Splatoon or Mario Maker, which sold like fucking hotcakes, so...
I like the gamepad.
I do too.
I like the gamepad. At King of Retro, has retro gaming / collecting just become a mainstream, in quotes, bandwagon hobby? Ian, you've seen people come into your store.
From where I sit, I don't want to use the term bandwagon in a negative way, because anyone who's interested in something, who wants to do something, should have that right and should have fun doing it. Has it become mainstream? Yeah, it's definitely become a bit more mainstream. I'm not saying everyone out there's got a fucking Nintendo collection, but everyone out there does walk into the store and go, hey, I think I want a Genesis, or hey, I think I want a Nintendo or a Super Nintendo. The phone at work is something that I just despise because it rings constantly off the hook. And it depends on what your term, your definition of retro is. If we go two generations back, I mean, between GameCube and N64 alone, I get 30 calls a day. So it has become mainstream. I don't necessarily think anyone's jumping on it because they think it's cool. I think a lot of these people just want a way to unwind with something that is familiar to them. And they are more aware of it being a hobby now, and they are more aware of it being something that if you look around in your phone book... Yeah, because people look in fucking phone books.
What's a phone book?
If you look around on your phone, or if you look around on eBay, you know, they realize how easy it is to get back into this now. It's not hard.
Now, what there are bandwagon people, there are bandwagon speculators.
Sure, yes.
And profiteers.
Yes.
You have people that have entered the hobby who are into toys, who are into other ventures, and saw and sniffed an opportunity to come in and become vultures. And I'm not saying, this, that people can't make money off of a hobby, but we're talking that people that strictly came in order to make as much money they could and disappear from it. And again, that's the right to do that, but when you talk about people that are buying up a few dozen Dinosaur Peak carts, I would argue, probably reasonably so, that's not good for the hobby.
No.
That's really not good for the hobby.
And I'll give you that. There are definitely bandwagon people who smell money, who are simply in it to buy, hold, and sell.
Game slabbers are mostly people that entered the hobby coming from being toy guys and figure, well, this is like a toy. I can slab these and buy these games and market them up. Those are mostly bandwagon people getting into the hobby.
But, you know, I mean, casual, you know, players, casual collectors, I don't think it's a bandwagon thing. I think it's really just, this is something I want to do. You know, I miss this part of my childhood. I have a 360, but I miss the simplicity of the cartridge. Because cartridges don't need updating. And then, you know, that's basically it.
That was a callback to a previous segment. Now, I will say, though, bandwagon retro game versus collecting, that could be different. Now, I don't... To me, it's weird when you want to get into the hobby, then all of a sudden, I want to get a complete NES collection. In 2015,
yes.
That to me is weird. Just because of the price alone, it's prohibitive to 99% of people, when before it was only prohibitive to make...
Well, because then I agree with you there. Because then it's become a status symbol.
Yes.
Once it reaches a certain price, it's no longer a collection because I'm genuinely interested in this. It's, I have these expensive games.
When people tell me that they got a little Samson, I bring this up before, but it's like, yeah, I got a little Samson. I'm just like, okay. You know, it's like, there's no secret handshake I show you now. You know, we don't get any benefits from having a little Samson. You know, I bought mine because it was one of the few games remaining, and it was under $120. I think I got mine for like $90 or $95, and that's why I bought it. Because at that point it was. But this, you bought yours for $700. Okay, I don't know. I don't know why you'd be proud of that for. I'm ashamed of a lot of the stuff I've spent a lot of money on.
Do you want to touch wieners? I mean, what do you want here? I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
Oh, you're asking rhetorically. Okay, it's making
sense. Yeah, anyways.
At Ryan EO Speedwagon. Well, at RyeGuy176. Was he a Ryback fan? My local pawn shop is starting to sell bootleg games, and they know for a fact that they're bootleg. Thoughts?
Okay, so I have to take this as two separate questions, and I'm in a gray area on both. But I'm definitely decided on one and gray on the other. Because you didn't specify, if they know they are bootleg and they are not telling anyone,
they know for a fact they're bootleg.
Right, but if they know they are bootleg and they are not telling anyone, then my thoughts are, the obvious thoughts, that's bullshit. That's horseshit. If they know they are bootleg, if they are selling them as such, and they are selling them for an appropriate price, and it's not something currently in print, so that people aren't losing money, my opinion gets a little bit murkier. And it's only because I know of people who collect certain bootlegs. I know people who collect Pokemon bootlegs, including the weird ones, like, you know, I don't know what the fuck they're called anymore, but like the weird, like, Game Boy and Game Boy Advance ones, like, you know, Pokemon, you know, fucking Boner Red, and Pokemon, you know, Deep Pearl, you know, Blonde, and I mean, they get all these weird names and shit, and they're these weird little hacks, and they're sold as bootlegs. Like, I understand that. I actually, that doesn't bother me too much. Now, if they're selling bootlegs of Fire Red, Leaf Green, Gold, Silver, Blue, Red, Yellow, even if they're announcing it, that to me is actually a little bit different, because those are generally poorly made, and you can get legit copies. I guess what I'm saying is, I'm just really using Pokemon as the example, because that's where most of the bootlegs are. I understand the curiosity of getting all these weird colors and all these bizarre ones that came out of, you know, China and Hong Kong that might interest some people. But bootleg cards in general are crappily made. And if they're selling them without people knowing, I would have to say that that's, you know, obviously total bullshit.
You're going to see more and more sort of situation like this happen, and people trading in fakes of GameStop. I know someone emailed me or alerted me to the fact that you can go online and buy fake, I guess, in bulk. I mean, you knew this before, but you can find the fake GBA Pokemon games in bulk and get them from overseas and have them come over here.
People used to do it all the time. I always get sketchy when people bring me a complete set of Game Boy Advance Pokemon games and everything looks perfect. I mean, barely without even looking at them, I'm like, these are bootleg. They bought a complete set offline for $30, not knowing they were bootleg, and they're bootleg and they want to get rid of them, and then a cursory glance at them tells me that they are, and I turn them away. You can totally do that.
So should we bust up the pawn shop? Should we?
Yeah.
is this the Pawn Stars story? You bring in the expert to look at your Game Boy Advance games?
I don't think you need an expert to determine a bootleg Pokemon cartridge. It's pretty easy.
Pawn Stars, what a nutty show. Who would go on that? All right, so we have a Patreon for the podcast. It's patreon.com/pixelsicle.
PXLSICLE.
It's so easy to type and pronounce and get people to. Anyway, so we got that going on. We're going to be at a... I'm going to be at Retropalooza by the time you hear this, so if you knew I was going to be there, come out and see me. That's September 26th and 27th, and today's the 23rd. Jesus. And then we'll be in Portland Retro Gaming Expo October 17th and 18th in beautiful Portland, Oregon. I got a book that's being worked on, Pat the Anise Punk's returning, my appetite's returning. This time I bought my burrito before the podcast so I can eat it later, my nice surf burrito. And then we'll see you in a couple weeks on October the 7th. So any last words, Ian?
I think you're all swell.
I think most of you are swell.
Most.
Some of you are probably swole as well.
90% swell, 75% swole.
Ian's getting swole.
We'll get there.
Combat ropes?
Battle ropes.
Battle ropes? I think.
Been going like 4 days a week.
That's when you actually you feel better? Are we going?
I've got a lot more stamina. Almost too much. It's not helping my sleep in any way, shape, or fucking form.
That's so. You gotta wear yourself out more then.
I'm wearing myself out. It's the adrenaline rush. Ask any doctor. That's why my old doctor told me not to exercise at night.
You have too much adrenaline?
Yeah. I mean, I get home from the gym at 10 and I fucking pace around for 2.5 hours before I can even sit down.
Wow. Okay. Oh, man. Okay. Sorry for that yawn. Oh, by the way, idiots online, when I yawn, it's not because... I know Ian's boring sometimes, but I'm not yawning because I think Ian's boring, because I'm fucking tired. If you didn't figure that out, we record this late after a long day. Anyway, for Ian Ferguson, I'm Pat Contry. Wow, I'm never this angry at the end of a podcast. Bye.
Bye.